Hello, welcome to Playback Daily. Trev here with you. Trevor Keegan, your personal content curator, because we've so many shows across RTE Radio 1 every day, there's always a chance you may miss some standout moments. So I boil down the best bits and cut off any grizzle. Although today I have left in a full fat story about a sausage.
The British sausage, along with chicken nuggets, are back on the menu today. Yes, it's talks in London about getting fresh foods from Great Britain into Northern Ireland.
I claim first dibs on the script rights for a crime-cracking tale that's like something direct from Hollywood.
It is transnational in its nature, with involving lots of different criminals and involving some 800 arrests from 100 countries.
And if you felt impending doom coming upon you during the night, it was probably your subconscious taking you back to the eve of the L word.
It's tremendously difficult any other year, but in particular this year with the whole online learning, and then we had the certain amount of assessments over the past few weeks, and then trying to learn now with the sun and stuff.
The highlights of RTE Radio. This is Playback Daily on RTE Radio 1.
If only I was a movie scriptwriter, I might start scribbling right now on the back of this story. You may have read or heard about how the FBI, along with international police forces, has rounded up over 800 criminals in a sensational sting operation involving a fake phone app that was supposed to be encrypted for exchanging information between criminals. But the whole system had been set up by the FBI, and the crime bosses bought it. Irishman and former Garda Michael O'Sullivan heads up the Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre in Lisbon, and he told Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland exactly how these shadowy figures were snared.
Codenamed Trojan Shield, the operation was jointly devised by the FBI and Australia. The criminals thought the devices were secure. What they didn't know was that the seller was the FBI. The encrypted messaging system called Anom was being used by an estimated 300 crime gangs across 100 countries. Over 20 million messages in 45 languages were intercepted. Now, while Gardaí have not commented directly on the operation, my next guest says Irish criminals were likely to be among the crime gangs targeted by this sting operation. The scale and the ingenuity of this operation, it reads like the stuff of a Hollywood movie. Will you tell us something about how global law enforcement put this sting together to essentially catch the criminals at their own game?
Well, I suppose, Mary, at this stage, it's a matter of public record what they've done, and they've involved some... It is transnational in its nature, with involving lots of different criminals and involving some 800 arrests from 100 countries. And when you look at that, when you look at the area of drug trafficking, transnational organized crime groups trafficking drugs from one side of the world to the other, from South America to Europe or from South America to other countries, whether it be Australia or otherwise, they're all made up of many different nationalities that come together. They pool the resources to buy in bulk. Gone are the days when one criminal group stood alone. It's now a multinational operation with multi-million euros being invested in it. It is about the more drugs you buy, the cheaper it costs, and the more profits you make. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, at its heart, Michael, what we have here is a communication system, a very sophisticated communication system, put together through an informant by the FBI. What the criminals didn't know was the FBI was the seller.
Yeah, absolutely. A great operation by Europol. But law enforcement have been quite successful over the last number of years. Recently, the EncroChat encryption system was breached by a mixture of an operation by the Dutch and the Belgians and the French. And when a system like that is breached, it is founded upon the principle and sold by individuals to organized crime groups on the understanding that this cannot be breached. Law enforcement will never find out either what you're texting or what you're sending. And very often it is the case that they become reliant on these systems. And when that happens and a system is taken down, as it has happened, as I said, in the last two or three occasions in the last 4 or 5 years, it deals a devastating blow once their communication system is gone, the fallout from it is enormous, the number of arrests, and that effect cascades down through the entire criminal network, where people, where evidence is obtained of people's drug smuggling and other criminal activities, with the results that it leads to further arrests, and it leads in many cases to the dismantling and disruption of organized crime. It's a huge blow to them, and they will be reeling from this for some time to come.
And you believe, Michael, that its reach will reach as far as Irish crime gangs as well, that it's inconceivable they would not be caught within the net of this sting?
Well, unfortunately for the Irish, Mary, some of the biggest organized crime groups in Europe contain and are managed by Irish criminals. So some of the really big ones are very much the senior management team are Irish. So I have no doubt that in one way or another, it will affect, if not them personally, their operations or their employees, for want of a better term, or the people who work with them, who supplied them with cash or supplied them with drugs. It will affect a lot of criminal networks, both here and abroad.
And why now? Why would international law enforcement decide to end the sting operation at this stage, to reveal the operation? And along the way, what might have had to be overlooked for a greater haul? Could that have included major drugs hauls? Could it have included crimes up to and including murder?
It's too difficult to say. It's really that's a question for Europol, and in these type of operations they have to make a judgment call. But again, not for me to say. But I would have no doubt that they brought this operation to the limit, and perhaps saw a point that they couldn't continue with it for various operational reasons. And sometimes in operations you gather so much evidence that it is practical and pragmatic to take the action now, as distinct from letting it run down the road.
Given the chaos created by the recent cyber attack on the HSE, author Ed O'Loughlin's latest novel, This Eden, couldn't be better timed. It has two main characters, one of whom unwittingly ends up working for a sinister tech mogul and is then coupled with a female spy, who then both end up being hunted by government agents and corporate goons. Ed joined Oliver Callan to tell us more.
It's a cyber thriller spy novel. It's got hacking in it. It's got tech billionaires, twisty plot. But This Eden, the new novel from Man Booker, long-listed Ed O'Loughlin, has a point to make as well. Good morning to you, Ed, in studio.
Good morning. Great, glad to be here.
It's nice to be face-to-face, you know, as we get into the tech thing. It's like we're off the grid or something.
Yeah.
Let's start first of all, because you're Irish-Canadian. Is that your identity? Is that how you identify? And let's get into your background so that we can judge you accordingly, as is the Irish way.
Well, I was born in Canada, but I grew up here. So okay. I have two badges I can wear. But, you know, I had a Canadian accent when I moved here when I was six, but it's long gone.
Which was, I'm sure, very welcomed and not commented on at all when you came to Ireland.
I was followed around at school and called the Yank.
Okay, right.
Which could not be more Canadian.
You didn't think of putting on a maple leaf or something. That's what they have to do sometimes, the poor old Canadians. So now I got straight into the book because it was reminiscent of Dave Eggers' novel The Circle, which was a great book and a kind of a dodgy film. But we meet two people straight away who are very kind of, they're sort of victims, aren't they, of the reality that big tech has created today.
Yeah, I mean, the book starts in Vancouver because I'd read a piece in The Economist several years ago about how the property market was turning Vancouver, which had been one of the world's most livable cities, according to lots of polls, into an unlivable city. So I picked that as a starting point when I was planning the novel. But, you know, as it moved on, I quickly realised that I could have just as soon have set it in Dublin. But
and of course, we soon meet the. Is it Taus? Is that how you connect?
Taus.
He says some pretty grim stuff about cyber warfare, and he's teaching these two. Well, he's teaching the kids involved, aren't they? I mean, start off, sorry, with the character. Like I said, two different victims. You've got Michael, he's in the gig economy, and tell us about his girlfriend, who's kind of the centre point at the beginning.
His girlfriend, who he's been with since college, is they're both engineering students, but she's a very good engineering student and he's a very poor one. So she goes into software engineering and then drops out because she's one of these people like Bill Gates and so many others in Palo Alto who are so good at computers they don't have to have a degree. But he's struggling, and she gets involved in all kinds of behind-the-scenes activist activities, and he can't really keep up with her, and they grow apart and things happen.
Yeah, and then he gets drawn into a world which he's not really prepared for.
He's completely sucked into this world. He does not belong there, and he has to. He gets recruited, unbeknownst to himself, into a plot to save the world.
Yeah, and this is where this Taos character we meet. He's sort of an activist, and there's also the billionaire Campbell Fess.
Yeah,
and so this Michael goes to meet him, and that's where I thought we were going to end up, in this kind of glass building in Silicon Valley for the whole thing, but. Obviously, things move along very quickly. But we're in this world, and it straight away feels very sinister, even though it looks very pretty and it feels like this is the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we're all seeing now the world we live in. We were being promised 20 years ago how the internet would change everything for the better. And while, you know, we're all addicted to it and it's very useful, it does have a very dark side. And that's, you know, where the idea from the novel came from, that we are living in a kind of a dystopian tech thriller, whether we like it or not. You know, if you write about kitchen sinks, you're, you know, that's no longer the realism. This is our new realism. Mm-hmm.
And is there a moment in time that you can kind of pick that sort of, because initially people were going, these are great fun renegades, the guys in hoodies who have disrupted old sectors that maybe needed to be disrupted because they were also monopolies in their own way. It seems to be around Cambridge Analytica, around that Facebook and the manipulation of data for the US elections in 2016, was that the key turning point where people sort of went, oh, hang on, what we're doing online is now a commodity that can be used to actually change the world around us?
Yeah, I think it became inescapable. And also we saw how tech was being used to leverage, you know, fake news, that it was being used to actually erode the very, the agreed, any consensus about what was true and what was false. And that was behind Trump. I think we see it with the Brexit campaign, and we see it further afield as well. And that's also something I deal with in the book. It's how our reality is under threat and how we have to fight to try and shore it back up again.
Because he used the term, of course, fake news, but post-truth was probably a better term, wasn't it, before that?
Yeah. Orwell predicted it back, you know, in the 40s, that the fake, false information could be used to flood out good information.
I was referencing the Taos character, and he's the one who says all these grim things to Michael, who's learning about this world, even though he's kind of been in it. But and I was pretty struck by one, which I have to ask you whether how deeply you researched it. I think they're in Jersey and they're looking at all the container shipments and kind of the RFID, the digital things. And he's saying they could be just hacked very simply, and you can totally disrupt the US economy for weeks and maybe forever, totally bypassing all the tanks and missiles and the old warfare that we knew with the drop of a hat.
Yeah, well, I kind of made up that particular detail. It occurred to me, I had my characters in New Jersey anyway, looking across at Newark, and I thought, what would they see? But it does, you know, speak to a broader point, which is that the warfare which is underway now is not about dropping bombs on railway sidings and communication centers anymore. It's about dropping viruses and hacking and ransomware attacks.
Which we know about now. And obviously the word data probably was a turnoff for people where they go, well, I'm not going to understand any of that. But we've got a first schooling in the last month in Ireland with the cyber attack on the HSE.
I think everyone understands it. I mean, it's like driving a car. We don't need to know how the car works to drive it. And we all drive cars in terms of we all have smartphones and we all have computers and we all to some degree rely on the internet, and we all see what's going on with the HSE hack. That really brought it home, I think, for people in Ireland.
Do you think, I mean, what is your message essentially here? Because people will say, you know, Facebook is the thing I get to stay in contact with someone. The pandemic has made technology really important, that people aren't as lonely because they were able to see, you know, they're able to do the FaceTiming thing. Zoom was obviously a huge thing for business as well as family and those personal connections. So it has done a substantial amount of good, hasn't it?
Well, that's the thing. You know, can we throw out the baby with the bathwater? The internet is a wonderful tool. It's just, you know, we are allowing the people who control it to do far too much with the data we give them about us. And we're allowing them to use it to manipulate us in ways that we don't fully understand or only beginning to comprehend now. And I think that the task is, you know, as with, you know, capitalism, it's poisoning the planet. But do we want to go and destroy it completely and go and live in caves or, you know, as hunter-gatherers? You know, we have to find a medium.
We still have to put ads on here and sell the book. And write
absolutely,
a book.
Yeah, buy the book.
You have to live under the system that's there. So when, because you're a journalist and you've had a long career, can you give us a kind of a brief sojourn of your travels as a journalist over the recent years?
Well, I mean, I started out in Dublin, in the Dublin Tribune, and then the Irish Times. And then the Irish Times sent me to Africa as their Africa correspondent in 94. And I ended up staying there for almost 8 years. I was back home for a year, and then the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age of Melbourne sent me to the Middle East. So I had, in total, almost 15 years as a foreign correspondent in Africa, in the Middle East. And then we moved back here in 2008 when the kids came along, and it's been a lot more sedate since then.
And your wife was a journalist as well?
She was, yeah. And now she works for the Legal Services Regulatory Authority.
That's Nuala Hawhi.
Communications, that's right, yeah.
And because the reason I'm asking about that is because you've turned to novels now, and I'm wondering, do you kind of see the genre of thriller maybe as a way to send the message that may not have got through or is not as easy to get through in journalism?
Yeah, in this case in particular, I mean, this is the only pure thriller I've written, and I may not write another one, but I just thought for this message and what I wanted to say, often I start off with a story and don't know why I'm writing it. In this case, I knew exactly why I was writing it, and I built the story around that purpose, and it could only really be a thriller because this is the world we live in.
So there is a message there, but maybe this is kind of the easier medium to get it through.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you're trying to get across a serious point, sometimes it's good to put a bit of sugar around the pill.
Have you given up on journalism then? Does that mean you're kind of...
No, I still freelance a bit, but...
But in terms of the belief that this will change the world, which I'm sure you had at some point.
I think journalism is still very important and it can still change the world, but, you know, I'm a bit long in the tooth and I think it's a young person's game.
Yeah. And in fairness, technology can be turned on its head as well. I mean, the FBI thing sounds ingenious, which we're hearing in the news now, that they invented an app that they could convince criminals was going to be totally encrypted and they were going to be able to communicate with each other without any law enforcement seeing it. Little did they know the FBI had created it.
Yeah, well, that's part of the asymmetric warfare that's going on. These guys are like the pirates who represent the big empires in the 17th century. You know, Russian hackers who are in some way linked to the Russian government, they're freelance, but, you know, out in the fringes of all this shadow war is going on is fascinating.
Yeah. Now, it all sounds heavy, but of course, I have mentioned Jason Bourne because it does feel like, you know, it's an adventure thriller. Michael travels around the world. And before he even leaves America, of course, he encounters this amazing character, Aoife. Tell us about Aoife, because she is obviously the Irish figure in all of this.
Aoife is quite, in some respects, an ordinary young middle-class Irish woman who discovers she has two unusual traits. She craves adventure, she realizes, and she's very, very good at being sneaky and deceptive. She's also very brave. And because she wants a challenge in life, she ends up ditching her law degree and going to work for the Police Service of Northern Ireland. Because she'd been reading the novels of Owen McNamee, and she's got the misconception that it's all very romantic because he has all these bruised RUC characters. And she ends up going from that into British intelligence because she's just very, very good at improvising and sneaky and sneaking around. And disillusioned, she finds herself freelancing and sucked into this plot. And she ends up being kind of almost a babysitter for the male character because he doesn't know what he's doing and she does.
But she's a bit of crack, isn't she?
Oh, she's very funny, yeah.
She's you have her coming from Kildare, which was your second home after Canada.
Yeah, well, it's where I grew up. I did a lot of research for my last novel, and I thought for this one I'm going to do it the easy way. So wherever possible, I used things that I knew about already rather than do any more research.
Yeah, because they're sort of on the run constantly from the billionaires and from the kind of system we've been talking about, the data centres and the surveillance, because it's very hard to go off grid. And I found myself kind of screaming in the book going, just come to Ireland where the rural broadband scheme is, you know, sneaking along. It's even the other day in the papers, it's delayed again. So that's where ultimately they do go.
Yeah, they end up back in Dublin. The book has its denouement on the Cross Guns Bridge in Phibsborough, which I thought needed to be, you know, dragged into a glamorous international spy story.
Yeah. Phibsborough. It's Phibsborough's hour with a GH, obviously.
Yeah. Cause,
but before we get there, obviously, there's a particular scene in Uganda, which, knowing that you're a journalist in Africa, it is pretty grim. Even though there's a very funny character, Bill Addison, he's a kind of a film natural, which I thought was a kind of one of those sleazy villains along the way that we encounter. But it did smack of, your memories, let's say, because you covered the Rwanda genocide, didn't you, in the mid-90s?
The aftermath, yeah.
The aftermath. Mm. Can you tell us your experience of covering that and what that did to your, you know, vocation as a journalist?
Well, that was the very first big foreign story I was sent on was the refugee crisis. The genocide, I guess, was still in some ways going on, but it was the when a million people crossed into across the border into the DRC, Zaire, as was, and you had a cholera epidemic. So tens of thousands of people died in the space of a few days, and that was where I was thrown in. That was my very first ever, you know, big foreign disaster story. So it was a real. Very much the deep end. I mean, I never actually saw anything else like that in my whole time as a foreign correspondent. So I guess it must have changed me in some ways. But
do you know how much it's changed you?
No, I'm still trying to work that out.
Okay.
I didn't think about it for a long time. Probably made me more reckless and initially more arrogant.
Why was that in the kind of I've been there, seen it all?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, when you've seen something that horrific, it's probably a little bit like being in a war yourself. You react in strange ways, and I hadn't had anything to steady me before that. But you know, I've gradually come down from it now.
Okay. What was your goal in setting out on this book? I mean, where was the motivating factor? Did it come from just anger at Silicon Valley and all it stands for, or a sort of a longing for how can we escape it?
The key idea, really, I had an idea one day, which was I was thinking about money, you know, money as it's leveraged by technology, as money now lives online. I mean, what is money? You know, we have people who are multi-billionaires, and yet where is their money? It's stored in, you know, zeros and ones in servers somewhere. And you look at the way these people behave, because of their money, and you have to ask yourself, do they own the money or does the money own them? Because, you know, you have vast corporations and billionaires lobbying against the fight against climate change, against the pollution of the planet. The planet's being poisoned. They live on the planet, and so do their kids, and yet they're poisoning it. And, you know, I began to wonder, you know, does the money own them or do they own the money? And I won't go into the spoilers, but...
No. Because it gets very Matrixy then, doesn't it, when they're with the subject of money. Actually, the cover is quite Matrixy. Does that in mind? Because you could see it on the big screen.
Yeah, I didn't design the cover. I wish I had, but okay. There's no grotesque rave scenes in it, so it's not that Matrixy.
Okay. That's one of the sequels, surely. Where did the inspiration for the billionaire come from? The tech billionaire, Mr. Fess.
He's really pretty much a stock character. I needed a kind of a villain in the background, and you know, it's such a so obvious, you know, we don't have to name names. We see these people who are, you know, incredibly rich and who are building spaceships and, you know, trying to abandon our planet, which they're destroying. And, you know,
some people might be glad to see them.
Yeah, that's, you know, it has been questioned. How do they know if we send them off to the moon that we let them come back?
But come here, when you finish a book like this, do you leave it alone? Are you still wrestling with these great subjects of, you know, is big tech poisoning and destroying the planet? I mean, you have to eventually, we all have to go to the supermarket and choose a flavour of yogurt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Come crashing back to reality.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've written the book. In fact, the book was written over a year ago and I've been kind of waiting for it to come out. So I've moved on to other things. I mean, I think I've said my piece for now. People haven't read it yet because it's only published tomorrow. But, you know, I'll see how it goes and maybe save the planet, you know, some further date, some further project in the future.
It's set in the pandemic. Actually, I've just reached the point. I'm about 100 pages from the end and it's 13th of March and you're writing it at that time. So what is the future dystopian book you've said that's set in the past?
Yeah, well, it was set in the present when I was writing it. Okay. And then I'd already written the first draft and it became, you know, COVID started to pop up in the news. And by February, when I was doing the edits, it was clear that COVID was going to be, you know, a much bigger thing than we would have hoped. And so I had to rewrite it a little bit to allow for that, because it was always going to be set in that present day. And I managed to hedge the bets with COVID. And in a way, having a year and a half of nothing happening is very useful for me, because I don't have to catch up.
And it's useful because they're off the grid, so they don't seem to know what's going on. And then they see a face mask appearing two thirds of the way through.
Yeah, I think like a lot of us, they didn't know what was going on.
It's kind of the first time I've seen that in a novel. And I think it's the Sunday Times said it was the first book in a pandemic, first Irish novel set in a pandemic so far. So are we ready for
is
that?
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, exactly. We're about to find out, aren't we? So what's next?
I wrote a kind of a short memoir last year that should be out sometime next year. And I've already started writing another novel, which has nothing to do with, it's just a very straight Irish novel about a bunch of young people going away for a weekend.
Very good, very different.
Very different, not at all a thriller. I'm not sure if anything's going to happen in it at all. But
that's very Man Booker, is it?
I was thinking more of the Nobel. I'm going to bypass the Man Booker.
Why not? Why not? Look, it's great. I love this, Eden. And there's also Edward Loughlin's book, Minds of Winter, is a great read, an introduction to polar exploration history for novices of that genre. I will reread it. I'm looking forward to reading his current book too, says that texter, 51551. This, Eden, is out. And by the way, do you engage with tech yourself? Do you try to live off the grid?
No, not at all. No, I'm as addicted to my phone as anybody else. I was waiting to come in the green room, retweeting all the tweets saying I was going to be on your show.
Yeah.
Maximising the impact.
Because it can, the book is actually such fun that, and you do have this kind of sense that this is the horrible reality, the dark reality you're in. But how do you feel? Are you confident about, optimistic about the world? Because it can sound like sometimes you're not so optimistic about it.
Oh, I think naturally, intellectually, I'm quite pessimistic. But, I think emotionally I am fairly optimistic. Most people are. We have that bias. And the book itself, I don't want to give away too much, but, we're looking at a planet that's, seems to be dying, is in big trouble. But, it's not dead yet. And there are still things that could be done. And it would be stupid to just assume that, we're doomed and throw up our hands in the air. We can still make an effort. And if that's the only shot we have to take it.
And if David Attenborough, who's in his 90s, still shares that kind of hope as well, then there's a taste of it for all of us. This Eden, Ed O'Loughlin, it's out tomorrow.
Liveline always brings us standout stories from day-to-day life, but this has to be a first for the show. It's definitely a first for me listening. I'll let Joe take up the story.
Anthony Hall. Anthony, good afternoon.
How's it going, Joe? How are you?
Good. Well,
Thanks for having me on.
Was this day last week? You say you came home and your house was gone.
My house was gone.
Disappeared.
Yeah. Disappeared. Yeah.
And was there anyone
down the banks of the Grand Canal and it was just gone?
And was there anyone standing around the spot where your house once stood saying, there it is, gone?
Yeah, yeah. All the boating community down in Lowtown Boatyard in Kildare basically standing around, and I came down the bank. They were kind of all just staring at me, and I just for a laugh, I turned around to the lads and I said, how's my boat doing? Is it gone? And they was like, no, it's actually gone.
But it was a houseboat. You lived on it?
Yeah, I was living on it, yeah.
So tell us, describe it to us first.
Okay, so it was a pontoon houseboat, something I built myself.
Okay.
They had them all over the UK, had them all over Amsterdam, all that kind of stuff. But apparently it's frowned upon by Waterways Ireland, and they basically lifted my houseboat out of the water on Wednesday last week.
And Waterways Ireland are the quango that own the canals, basically.
Yeah,
they
basically,
own it.
Yeah.
They own everything.
Yeah, basically. I don't know. There's a lot of people that say they don't actually own the canals. They only own what's on the banks of the canals. But then again, it's like a grey line.
So where is your house gone?
My house is gone. They took it. They loaded it up onto a low loader and they took it to Shannon Harbour in Offaly on the other side of the country.
And how can you get your house back?
I can't. Inland Waterways are looking for €2,500 off me, a haulage fee, which I can't afford. Mm-hmm. And I have no home, currently sleeping on a friend's couch at the moment.
And are they billing you for lifting? That's a big job.
They're billing me for the lift, the haulage, crane, low loader, staff. There was 4 Gardaí present as well to take me out of my home. I don't understand it whatsoever. It was crazy.
So the cost of the crane was $5,000, basically.
Yeah, well, they reckon the total cost came in at somewhere around $5,000 and they hit me with a bill of $2,500.
So you'd have to pay $7,500.
Well, no, they want $2,500 off me, but for me to get my boat home, or anywhere near me, okay, it's going to cost me like another haulage fee. So you could be,
but you can't. You will not be permitted to return the structure any navigation managed by Waterways Ireland.
Yeah, so they won't give me my boat back unless I've paid the fee. So my boat is now in a compound over in Shannon Harbour.
And they'll keep it for a month.
They keep it for a month, otherwise it gets put up for a legal tender or destroyed. So, yeah.
Now, it is a beautiful structure. I don't know if we tweeted it yet, but it is very well made. It's not your trade.
Yeah, no, it's the first time I ever built a boat. It was kind of a lockdown project. Yeah. What happened was I was living at home due to personal circumstances. Anyway, I moved out, renting, moved home. Then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So I was like, right, I was living with my man and dad. So I said, look, I don't want to be living with my man and dad when there's a pandemic on. So I was kind of living on friends' couches and stuff like that. And then I just kind of took it in my head to build a boat, like a way out of, you know, the rent and the housing crisis. So I was just like, no, I can't do it. I can't afford it. I was like, I'll put my last few quid I have into building this houseboat. So I found this big hay shed out in Ballateague, and I started building it in the depths of winter. And I got it to a place where I felt like happy with it. It's good. It's nice. It's structurally sound. The feedback I've had about the house has been fantastic. And so I launched it, floated perfectly. There's not a problem with it. Waterways clearly had a problem with it.
And Anthony, how is it floating?
It's floating on 220-litre barrels.
They're the big blue barrels,
Big blue drums, yeah.
Yeah, drums.
But
yeah.
You can't see the blue drums. I've built this sheet metal around it. It just looks like a normal hull of a boat. But it's a...
Can it move? Can it move?
Yeah. I came under three bridges on a lock on the way down to where it was.
Can it move of its own volition? Have you an engine on it?
No. See, that's the thing. Waterways Ireland came down to me. Two authorities from Waterways Ireland came down to me and they said, lovely boat. Congratulations. You've done a great job. I was like, oh, thanks very much. You want to come on in? Mm-hmm. Invited them in, the whole lot. They asked me, are you living on it? I said, yeah, I'm living on it. They said, you've done a great job, amazing. I said, look, I know there's a standard, there's a mooring fee you have to pay. What everyone else in the country pays for living on the canals, €126.
A year?
I said, a year, yeah.
That's not bad. Is it €2
well, you're
a
not,
week?
You're not actually, apparently, you're not actually legally allowed to live on the canal, but there's hundreds of people living all over the canals in Ireland.
Yes, there is.
But waterways have kind of set a precedence with that kind of thing, you know. So I just figured, look, I'd shoot my shot and build a boat and put it in.
And what's on? Many rooms on the boat?
It's one big bedroom, bathroom and a kitchen dining room.
And heating?
Yeah, I have a solid fuel stove with a back boiler, running a few radiators and stuff like that, yeah.
And sanitation and plumbing?
That was all going to be, kind of be chemical toilets and all that kind of stuff, but they have facilities there in Lowtown Boatyard to deal with all that kind of thing.
Okay.
Were you
not like putting it up to them? Isn't there a Waterways Ireland depot at Lowtown, given its incredible location?
Yeah, I was in work. I went out early that morning for work. I was surface dressing, and we got rained off. And I came home early, and my boat was gone. I came walking down the banks, and my boat was gone.
But did you get a notice a week beforehand, a month beforehand, saying?
No, I got a notice saying my boat was going to be lifted in 10 days. That was the date the letter was written. But I got really realistically about 8 days. I sent on the mooring fee like I told the officials from Waterways I would, and they sent me back the fee along with my boat being gone.
Now, unfortunately, Waterways Ireland, you were a massive taxpayer funded north and south body, but unfortunately they don't. Just as I was looking at the letters they sent you, all the letters are PP'd by someone whose name I can't read, something or other, on behalf of someone else's name I can read.
Yeah. Yeah.
But everything.
To be honest with you, Joe, I feel.
What's not that? Anyway, let me read out the statement. We won't go into. Waterways Ireland removed an illegal construction from the navigation in compliance with the bylaws. The bylaws are clear what constitutes a boat. A set of barrels with a garden shed on top does not meet the minimum safety, seaworthy, or navigation criteria. A set of barrels with a garden shed on top.
Does it look like that to you in the photos? No,
we tweeted the photographs on that Joe Live and at RT Live and asked the people. It looks like a very, very well built cabin. Yeah. With a kind of porch at the front, but the porch at the front is actually facing into the water. It looks very, it's no way haphazard in terms of its construction.
No, not at all.
Is it durable? Will it last?
It will last forever. The barrels will never deteriorate. They're solid plastic, 10 mil plastic. The exterior is galvanized sheeting, 25-year non-rust. You don't even have to paint it. You don't have to treat it. You don't have to do anything with it. It just literally sits there, or take it wherever you want. It's like, it's perfect. They have them all over the UK. They have them all over Amsterdam. But just, this is Ireland's way of backwards thinking. It's a joke. It's gone beyond a joke now, I think.
And there's two canals meet at Lowtown. Is that right?
Yeah, there's different lines. There's like a Barrow line and the Shannon line.
Oh, beautiful.
And that kind of brings you into Dublin.
And it's an incredible resource, our canals. Incredibly underused as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
But incredible resource. It really is, for especially in the world we're now living in. Fire safety. How would you get out in the event of a fire? Now, there's plenty of water around you, but how would you
So I have a front door, front and back.
Have you? Okay, so you have a back door on it. Oh, I didn't know.
A back door as well, there for fire safety reasons. So if there's a fire in the front, I just go out the back door. Yeah. Like a barge, like any barge. All barges are built with a front and back door.
Are you causing an obstruction to anyone?
Absolutely no. Wide beam barge is 12 foot wide. This structure is 10 foot wide by 35 foot long. So it's smaller than any wide beam barge in the country.
And do you want? Can you tell me how much it costs you to make? How much you stand to lose? In other words,
I'm into this for about 8,500-9,000 euros now at the moment, plus about 1 million man hours. It's taken all my money, all my time, and it was a desperate act to get from underneath the housing crisis that's going on, because I couldn't afford the rent. Now I have no money, I have no house, and I'm sleeping on a friend's couch currently at the moment.
As rents continue to preclude many people from city locations around the country, and sick pay for some sectors simply doesn't exist, our political correspondent Micheál Lehan told Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland about government discussions to try to tackle both issues.
This is a move by the Housing Minister to extend those protections that are in place for some renters but were due to expire on the 12th of July. And they are for people who are in arrears or who have made a declaration that they have an inability to pay now as a result of the pandemic. Those protections will be extended, allowing for no rent freezes and no evictions from the 12th of July now until January. I suppose in the Dáil last week, there was a fairly robust debate at times, though, saying that this doesn't apply to many, many other renters who do face the prospect of rent increases in some rent pressure zones. It's estimated this could run up to 8%, given a loophole around that particular set of legislation when it comes to rent increases in those zones. The government saying that that longer piece of legislation is something that is being looked at and will be worked on as well. But this is the immediate first step. That other piece of work seems probably some months off when it comes to those kind of rates and those kind of increases. But this is the first step, applying to those renters who are experiencing financial difficulty as a result of the pandemic.
So for those in arrears only. And are these measures still linked to the public health measures in law, Micheál? Because they had been tied, I think, previously to the 5K rule.
Yeah, and that is why the 12th of July is a particularly important date there, because that's when those emergency pieces of legislation covering rent would expire. So in the normal course of events, as a result of where the easing of restrictions is at the moment, that would have been the date when these would have ended. Those safeguards and more comprehensive safeguards that were in place began to be withdrawn in the aftermath of particularly the travel restrictions being eased. And I suppose that has led to the call from the opposition and many housing bodies as well, saying there is a need for a more comprehensive moratorium on evictions and on rent increases, at least until the end of the summer and perhaps until the end of the year.
And they're also going to restrict upfront payments to a maximum of 2 months' rent. Is that for everyone?
Yeah, that is a piece of legislation that the Housing Minister believes is particularly relevant for many people, but very relevant indeed for students who are being asked for large sums up front. So a new piece of legislation will now be introduced that will mean The total value that tenants would have to give over cannot exceed 2 months, and that includes the deposit. In particular instances where students staying in student accommodation want to pay more upfront, they will be entitled to do so. There's also another safeguard for students being introduced, that they would have to give a maximum of just 28 days to quit a tenancy.
Now, in relation to sick pay, and this was exposed during the pandemic, particularly among low-paid workers and during outbreaks in places like some meat factories, this was exposed as a reason for people staying in work rather than staying at home if they had symptoms. What's being proposed here, Micheál?
Yeah, this has been spoken about for a number of months now, but the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar bringing a proposal to Cabinet today that seems to move this towards the outline of legislation, and its introduction on a phase basis expected next year. That's when it would begin, and this would create a base payment really that would allow all workers to receive the benefit of sick pay. The exact detail of how much is being considered being discussed at this point, that's a matter for Cabinet to be finalised. But when it was talked about before, they were saying that it would be a percentage of people's earnings and perhaps up to 2 weeks in the year where they would be entitled to do that as a first measure, entitled to claim this payment. It's likely to begin on a phase basis next year, where those workers who don't have an entitlement to a sick pay scheme could receive a number of days sick pay, and then it would be extended over possibly the next 3 to 4 years. This has been done to give companies, particularly small companies, the chance to plan for it. It's expected too, though, in the discussions that have been ongoing about this, that there would be help provided by the state for these companies in a way that you see already with maternity and paternity benefit.
So is it some time still off before a statutory sick pay scheme in full is in place for all?
It'll be several years before there's perhaps a full comprehensive one, but you begin to see the start of it and at least some sick days payment in place from next year onwards. That seems to be the plan as it stands at the moment. And I think government too saying that it's important to point out that for the many companies that do have such a system in place, that should remain and shouldn't be phased out or changed in any way to link it in with this new system, which does seem to be about creating a base or a safety net for the many workers who, it was evidenced during the course of the pandemic, had no such protections at all.
Presumably the opposition, well, they'll support it, but presumably will want it speeded up a little bit.
Yeah, I think in particular there were several opposition proposals, including one from the Labour Party that says this should be quickly introduced because Ireland is one of the few EU countries that doesn't have this provision in place. And the Labour Party and other parties have said this is something that should be moved on quickly and in a more comprehensive fashion, and that should be possible to bring Ireland in line with other EU countries. A feeling in government that where things stand economically, that it has to move a little bit slower. So the key test of this will be just to see how quickly it does move next year and what or how comprehensive the level of cover that will be introduced from the beginning next year will be.
Later, Damien O'Reilly, who's covering on Today with Claire Byrne, heard the other side of the argument from Margaret McCormack. Margaret is the information officer with the Irish Property Owners Association.
Margaret, your reaction to the proposals in relation to the ban on landlords from taking more than 1 month's rent up front, and obviously the new protections for renters that is being discussed this morning. What is your reaction?
The first thing I would say is that our landlords have been excellent. They have worked with tenants, they have dealt with situations, they've given forbearance, they've been patient, some rent forgiveness, some rent reductions. They have been really, really good, and that needs to be acknowledged. The next thing I would say is, around a deposit, it needs to be the landlord who chooses the amount, because 1 month's deposit doesn't protect an asset. The financial risk is the landlord's. The landlord has borrowed. The landlord has the financial risk. It's then the landlord that will lose. And the time taken around rent arrears in any situation is appalling. So a tenant has statutory items that they must receive in a rent arrears situation. So it can take 2 months to serve the notices for rent arrears. And we have 1 month's deposit, and that doesn't protect the landlord at all.
But hasn't the traditional arrangement always been 1 month up front and a deposit?
Yeah, traditionally in Ireland, it was 1 month deposit and 1 month rent in advance. And this was prior to the Residential Tenancies Act. So prior to that, the legislation allowed that a tenancy could be terminated giving a notice of 1 month. Now, that's gone. That law, there's much more and much greater protections in place for tenants. And in the case of tenants now, it takes a long time for a landlord to go through the process that the state has set up, which protect a tenant, but they don't protect a landlord. So it can take up to 18 months to go through the process for the state's process if you have a tenant that's not paying rent.
Okay,
and the person who loses is the landlord, not, you know, the state doesn't come back and say, oh, well, you've lost 18 months of rent here. We're protecting the tenant, so we'll pay you that. They don't do that.
But for we'll say one unit investor landlords who are paying back a mortgage to the bank, have the bank been playing ball with them over the last 15 months? In other words, have they been looking for the principal repayment, or have they taken into consideration the fact that obviously the renters are only able to afford little or nothing?
We're dealing with a small amount of renters that are in trouble, generally. Most landlords have been able to either negotiate something with their bank, but where they have, they still have to pay the interest. So it's not a question that they're getting a write-off. They have to pay the interest. The interest is still accruing, and the cost, and it extends out the length of the mortgage. So there's nothing there. But back to your deposit. The risk is the landlord's. The landlord needs to be able to manage that risk. And the state keeps putting protection on one side, on the tenant side, without giving any protection to the landlord.
What do you think would be a reasonable amount of money as a deposit? How many months' deposit?
Germany does 3.
Now, as US President Joe Biden has a lot of things on his plate, but British sausages may not be one of them if he's asked to take sides in the ongoing row over the Northern Ireland Protocol. Joe, of course, will be chewing the fat, but again, maybe not from a local sausage, as he attends the G7 summit in Cornwall, where it's likely Boris Johnson will be bending his ear looking to be his best friend. Our London editor, Sean Whelan, told us why.
The British sausage, along with chicken nuggets, are back on the menu today. Yes, it's talks in London about getting fresh foods from Great Britain into Northern Ireland without requiring checks. Customs checks at ports were agreed by the British government and the European Commission as part of the protocol, which left the North inside the EU single market for goods. A grace period for no checks was unilaterally extended by the British last year, and that runs out at the end of this month. We can talk to our London editor, Sean Whelan. Sean, talks today between Maros Sefcovic, the European Commission's Vice President, and Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost in London. In about half an hour's time, they get underway. Have they any new proposals to get around this?
They've bits of new proposals, but essentially they are still dancing around the same fundamental problem. That is, the British side do not want to be, as they would see it, locked into EU laws that would be changed over years in Brussels without them having a say in it. They want a situation whereby effectively the EU would trust and accept British laws and implementation of veterinary checks and food safety checks. Right now, it doesn't present a problem because they're both operating the same system. But as time goes on, those systems are expected to diverge. And the European side say we can't take the risk of opening up a big hole in the fence into our market from such a big trading partner anchored right offshore of the European Union. And the British say we can't accept a situation whereby rules are going to be set in Brussels. And trying to find some kind of a bridge between those two pretty fundamental positions is where the talks are aimed at right now. Certainly from the British perspective, they're saying we should be able to find some kind of a space between those two hardcore positions in which we can operate what they call a pragmatic solution. The EU have suggested this over the past week or so, that the British should sign up to the operating the EU rules, but on a temporary basis, because they say we understand your need to negotiate other trade deals with other countries like America or Australia, but you haven't done any yet. So until it becomes a problem, why not just carry on operating the EU rules on an interim basis? And that would remove 80% of the checks that are being required under the agreement as it stands at the moment. But and as we say, nothing likely to come out of that unless some miracle has happened overnight. Expectations for today's talks are pretty low, I have to say.
And in the meantime, listening to business representatives in the north, they are sourcing goods more locally and from this side of the border as well. But that won't lower the temperature among loyalists who are opposed to the protocol.
No, and they have a fundamental point here, which is the protocol, all the emphasis on it was about the north-south free movement and making sure there was no border on the island of Ireland. Loyalist communities in the north are particularly exercised at restrictions on that east-west dimension of the Good Friday Agreement. So a lot more attention is being focused on easements and technical fixes to try and reduce to the absolute minimum the impact of Brexit and the protocol on that east-west relationship. And you know, sourcing more goods locally or sourcing supplies in the Republic, yes, it gets you over the hump. It means you've got your food supplies coming through in a timely basis, but it doesn't really overcome the problem that they would like to import stuff directly from the UK. Also, I mean, it affects Irish supermarkets in the south. It affects French supermarkets, Dutch supermarkets. If there was a veterinary agreement in place, it would make things a lot easier for British companies exporting to those countries and for the British supermarket supply chains moving food in and out in the way that we've all become used to over the decades.
And just finally, Sean, for now, Joe Biden, the US president, he's in Britain tomorrow meeting the prime minister as part of the G7 summit in Cornwall. Is he likely to intervene in this?
That's the big question. And I think this is the time of or one of those occasions of maximum pressure that the EU can try and exert. Both sides are accusing the other of trying to quote unquote spin Joe Biden to come down on one side or the other to put pressure on. But certainly it is, as the EU would see it, an opportune moment to ramp up the pressure, because not only will Joe Biden be there, but you've also got the leaders of France, Germany, Italy and the European Commission and the European Council sitting at the table. So, you know, you've got half the table potentially against Boris Johnson. If Joe Biden was to come in on either side there, it could make for a kind of awkward dinner table conversations. So it is a time when they will push hard. Today, effectively, the EU will push hard. And there's the risk to the British that these outcome today might spill over into the G7 talks. Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen spoke yesterday evening about this, and the EU president did raise the prospect of conversations of some sort carrying on into the G7 over the coming days. And I don't think that will be welcomed on the British side. They would prefer, I think, to try and bury technical fixes in the technical undergrowth. But the technical undergrowth is very, very difficult. And the solutions that are being proposed are all very last minute and are not very well worked out on either side.
Oliver Callan likes to make us laugh with Callan's Kicks, of course. But over the last week or so, he's also been giving us a giggle as the fill-in presenter on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Earlier, he had his usual peruse of the papers, and a Daily Telegraph review caught his comedic eye.
The Duchess of Sussex, otherwise known as Meghan, has released her first children's book, and the Daily Telegraph in London, which is they're not exactly fans, are they? Well, they've given a stinker review to the kids' book. It's called The Bench. And the article opens, "The Duchess's first children's book is all bland parenting wisdom, in inverted commas, and no story. It's hard to imagine any child enjoying it. So this is your bench," the story begins, accompanied by a watery illustration of a man with ginger hair sitting on a bench, looking adoringly into the eyes of a baby. Who could this ginger man be? This lovely dad. "Where life will begin for you and your son." And The Bench, it's published today, apparently based on a poem Meghan wrote for Harry on Father's Day. And it's all about the son learning to ride a bike, the hero who will watch on with pride is clearly Harry. And anyway, they finish by saying, "One wonders how any publisher could have thought fit to publish this grammar-defying set of badly rhyming cod homilies, let alone think any child anywhere would want to read it. But that's Planet Sussex for you, where even the business of raising a family is all about the brand." Ooh, this is part of the culture battles they're having over there. I think some university has tried to remove a picture of the Queen as well in Oxford University because they said it's too colonial for them. You know, it is a picture of the Queen. Anyway, the culture wars will continue on and we can look with our wry glances and pretend we're all above them. Ha ha! We don't have any classism or tribalism in Ireland at all. No. Where are you from, Mayo? I'm judging you right now.
For some, Meghan can do no right. And for some, Meghan can do no wrong. Oliver, meanwhile, just keep doing what you're doing. I don't have much time to do what I'm doing left, though, because I just can tell you a quick reminder that you can listen back to all your favourite shows on RTE Radio 1 on the RTE Radio Player app or get the best bits here on Playback Daily. I'll leave you with Brian Reedy and Dopamine. It's from the RTE Radio 1 recommends list and was heard earlier with Shay on Rising Time. From me, Trevor Keegan, happy listening and bye for now.
Saw you yesterday and I smiled. Saw you yesterday and it hurt a little while. It's only in the night when I sleep. It's only in the night that my dreams set me free. It's only when the noise stops can you hear yourself. Can you hear yourself? Can you hear yourself? Searching for my dopamine. I'm searching for my favorite dopamine machine. 20 milligrams. It's only when the noise stops can you hear yourself.